Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on raconteursnews.com. Bit of a late start there, but we did manage to get it fixed without the help of the surgery tech team, so clearly we're learning a bit of stuff. That was Clutch and X-ray vision. A psychic warfare is real. Too bloody right. If only that was the worst of it, eh? And a guest appearance from Sergeant Butterman from Hot Fuzz the movie. I rather like that sound effect. Before that, Chumbawamba and Admi, emphasising the dangers of the technosphere. And before that, Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra, Danse de la Limonade, because I just fancied kicking it off with a bit of straw-raising tunage. Well, I have it in mind to consider community tonight and how we're getting on together. The reasons for that are many, and I'm sure will become clear as I go through. But it's mostly because, at the moment, I think we have the opportunity to change the way we're living and the way we get on with each other. I think we have some of the abilities we need to manage the managers to an extent where we do actually gain ourselves a bit of breathing space to live and work together. I think so. The knowledge is there. The opportunity is there. I think that the will is now there as well. I was this morning at a meeting which followed a protest rally in our small local town about the closure of schools. And it attracted several hundred people, actually, which for around here is a lot. And I noticed that there is a distinct drive now to try and unite people who are, shall we say, experiencing a bit of problems with the way things are being managed, administered. There's a lot of interest in the kind of things that we like to talk about, and I think that one way or another, it's what we absolutely need. What we absolutely need to do. Well, the thing is that over the last 4 years, I've spent a lot of time with Synchro moving around various communities and clusters of people. And in the years running up to that, I spent a lot of time in various different factories and all sorts of different working environments. And so I've encountered a lot of what I would call communities, because I think that anybody with a shared intent that's getting to see who are getting to see each other regularly effectively form a community of some sort. And one of the things that struck me again and again is that for some reason people just don't seem to be getting on. Now, whilst I think it's really important, as I say, that we manage to keep certain people outside our gates, I think it's probably just as important that we learn to manage ourselves, really. There isn't much hope of managing other people. The school protest or meeting I went to this morning suggests to me that the time to learn about effective action is now upon us. Several of the people I spoke to suggested to me that they've known for quite a long time that things are seriously wrong, but they don't really know what to do about it. And in my process around the room, I did actually discover people who understand that there's a difference between the normal English spoken by the rest of us and the English that's spoken and used by the legal profession. Now, I was quite surprised to discover that. I was hoping to get some little interviews done whilst I was there this morning, but it all turned out to be a bit noisy and frantic. So I have got several people to get in touch with for a later show, because it seems to me that where schools and children are concerned, that is where the popular feeling is welling up round here. I think the other reason why community is important to me is it's something I've been actually seeking for as long as I can remember, really, from right back when I was at school. And I still remain, despite all of my experiences, I remain absolutely convinced that that it is a feasible thing. But as we go through, what would be really great is if any of you out there in the chat box would like to call in and give me your 10 penneth on how you think community might best be organised. Because the questions have been occurring to me, I put out in the blog for the show, and one of them is how best can we rediscover our ability to live and operate together, because it is something that we did used to have, and it appears somehow to have been more or less driven away. I've given a lot of time to considering whether conflict and hostile behaviours are actually inevitable. You know, when every time people come together, it seems to me that such things are experienced. They kind of arise. Whether they're inevitable or not, I think deserves some thought, and whether there's anything we as individuals can do about them, whether our individual actions actually make a difference to how situations develop around us. One of the things we see as a result of the standard drive to divide and rule is that really, really good ideas and excellent people come to the fore, do a lot of really good work, and eventually get exhausted and kind of fade away. This is mostly, I think, because it's not easy for us to get kind of administrative support and things like that, because none of us have got any cash, as it were, to kind of recompense such things. However, in small groups now, there are quite a lot of people working together for the benefits of each other. The problem is that whilst we're working in that way, our aims, our lessons, our learning, our wisdom doesn't achieve any longevity, and any unity that we do manage to experience seems to fairly quickly evaporate. So I'm wondering whether we can assure the unity and longevity of our purpose basically through our own actions, through our individual actions. Obviously, what the group is doing counts, but I think it's down to us eventually. And really, boy, I've had some interesting discussions this week. I wandered into a sitting room because I had to be there, and the lady whose house it was had the telly on, and said, there's always politicians on at this time of night. And I said, oh, well, I don't pay any attention to them. And she said, well, you should. And then she went for me, basically, told me that we needed government, asked me whether I'd read Plato's Republic and various other things. And I'm sure it's an attitude that we all come across, that, because I have a set of ideas, I have a right to kind of impose it on you. But I think one of the basic concepts to community is, was it Albert Pike who said that those who are not fit to govern themselves are fit only to be governed? I suspect that's a paraphrase. But it is what a lot of people believe. And the thing is, it doesn't just work on the big scale of society, in my opinion. It works its way right the way down to the community level. So you have people who believe that we can't cut our own swathe in this life, and that somehow everything will go really, really crazy if people start managing themselves. But when you look out at what's actually going on, I mean, just look out at it and tell me that it's not crazy as it is, but people just don't seem to have noticed. And I mean, in the 60s and 70s, I think this is one of the problems. Obviously, the word community we have problems with anyway because of its legal sense, but I'm going to use it anyway. But in the 60s and 70s, communities were typically thought of as being kind of good life type things, where nobody had any privacy and all that kind of stuff. And people I know who are around in those years say to me, they say, you know, oh, community is impossible. I want to have my own front door and all that sort of stuff. But it seems to me that community isn't just that sort of thing. You know, the family is a community. The extended family is a community. People who are dwelling and working closely together form a community. And in all of these places, what I see is a lot of tension. They're kind of kept in place in a lot of traditional hierarchical production facilities, shall we say. But one of the things that's arising now, which I haven't seen before, and I've spent a lot of time reading management manuals of one sort or another, is the tendency for organizations to form themselves into fairly free-flowing small teams, such that everybody has view of budgets, everybody can spend those budgets, come up with ideas. The basic drive of the thing is that rather than having a steady job description, people do what they see needs to be done. It's something hopefully I'll be looking at in a little more detail later in the show, but it is something that's completely different from the usual way of running things, and it's something that has arisen apparently spontaneously a lot of the main studies in this particular field are to do with corporations, which is a bit annoying, really. But the reason I think why that's done is because in the corporate world, as everything is measured and recorded and written down, it therefore makes it a lot easier to see where the benefits are and compare them with the situation as it was before. One of my main sources for this is a book called Reinventing Organizations, which I think we're probably going to be hearing a fair bit about as I wander around looking at actual organizations and seeing what's working this way. But it could just as well, it occurred to me today when I was looking at it, be called Reinventing Communities, because whilst the book is about entirely corporate entities, my own experience is that similar sort of methods are now arising outside the corporate realm, in the private, as it were. So events like Fire in the Mountain Festival, which Synchro and I both crew at, has been run on these bases since its inception, which was about 5 years ago now. I think this is its fifth year. It's doing very well for itself. And to them, the discovery of this book was really great, because they looked at all these principles and realized of freedom and equality, free flow of information, open books, all that kind of stuff. And they realized that they already had a lot of it actually in place, which made it a lot easier for them to think about installing the rest. One of the things, of course, I'm thinking about is a certain young radio station where we are, by definition, forming ourselves into a community. That's one of the reasons why I'd like people to call in either on dr.rock2012 on Skype, or find some way of getting me a phone number and I can call you back. But it's at these early stages of the forming of projects that we can perhaps start thinking about taking on board some of the new ways of running things, because it can be a lot more, well, all the evidence is that it's a lot more fun and a lot more rewarding. And I don't think that just because all of the text on it has been written about work doesn't mean to say we shouldn't start playing with it as well. So in the community field, mostly what we've encountered has been places where somebody owns the place where everybody else is one way or the other working, or has some kind, believes themselves to have some sort of title to it, as do most other people, of course. And it seems that it's very difficult for the group to, it's quite often very difficult even for good ideas to be expressed and executed in such places. They tend to be, I've as yet got to come across one, which allows for the freedom of, intuition and, what's it called? When you exercise your own agency. Just a word that slipped my mind at the moment. But when you take responsibility for change and things like that, it all tends to be just a little bit controlled. The proprietorial attitude, it seems to me, is extremely unhelpful. But that's the fact that we know, don't we, that all title is illusory anyway. Well, our discovery has been that, really, having seen that, we don't really actually want to own anything. And distributing ownership via a trust or however it's done really does tend to work a lot better, because then you can get a genuinely participative management structure kind of in place. So at the moment, functional communities that have been around for a while are quite rare, and there's a tendency for them to get into difficulty after they've been around for, I don't know, maybe 10 or maybe 20 years. And it seems that one of the reasons why this happens is because eventually people just get into ruts, because people might have specific jobs. You know, somebody might have just kind of assumed the job of getting all the wood in or something like that. And stuff becomes kind of set that really ought to be a little bit more versatile. The point about the new ways of doing things is that once a job's been done, so say a load of wood's been got in, then everybody who's been involved in that looks around for something else to do, forms up with new teams of people to try and see to the next objective. And it's my hope that we're going to see a lot more actually functional, long-living communities if people can realise this sort of stuff. And, I mean, for me, some of the principles we've developed seem to work really well. So a basic desire to do more than is expected, and to do so cheerfully is like really, really great way of doing things. And obviously it's not a kind of a guaranteed deal that way. I think often if we've put in a lot of effort and all that's required is just a lot more effort, then probably we'd use that as a means of looking at a project that we might want to move on from. I think another important thing is that I've realized that in the crews that I work in and the various places I've gone, where people are dealing with each other honestly and compassionately, things go a lot more smoothly. And it is actually possible to have like a team of 100 individuals who can do that quite happily. It's also possible that some people might have a bit of a problem with each other, and generally speaking, it's up to them to sort it out. But in all cases, when we look at people that are having a difficult time and who are operating out of fear or, I don't know, whatever, what else do people put it down to? They put it down to ego. Whenever we see that sort of stuff happening around us, partly we need to understand that we can only comprehend that behavior through our own experience, through our own mental furniture, and that what we are seeing is therefore to a more than certain extent a reflection of ourselves. So a lot of the things, it seems to me, that cause trouble, that people want to have a go at, are actually an opportunity for kind of work inside, because they are a reflection of how we're feeling. And if, you know, everybody has had similar experiences to ours, or, you know, we've all got parents, we've all got tutors, we've all got various people who've educated us in one thing or another. And it was once said to me that if we had all the same variables as somebody else, so if we had their parents, their teachers, their brothers and sisters, their general condition, as it were, then it's folly to deny that we'd be doing anything other than what they're doing, or to suggest that we'd be doing anything than what they're doing. It's kind of there for the grace of God, but for the grace of God go I. And once again, this not only helps communication with other people, I find it really helps keep me calm. You know, we're all aware, aren't we, that there are huge levels of difficulties facing all of us, but every single one of us seems to be developing the unique techniques necessary to keep our head above water or make progress or whatever, however it is we want to put it. It seems to me that an approach I see used around me a lot is for people to address interpersonal problems by talking about it to other people, which can be helpful by way of preparation, but actually I think it's always better to deal, as I say, compassionately and peacefully with the individual that we need to deal with, because that's where the opportunity for breakthrough is. And another thing that seems to happen a lot is that people have a go. People can slip into a kind of abusive state without actually finding out what's going on. And this is unbelievably common, that assumptions and presumptions are made. Perhaps it's that we're taking examples from the world management team and kind of filtering them in to our everyday life. The fundamental thing behind all of these, I think, turns out to be actually taking responsibility for ourselves. I once had a chap on a show who's done a lot of work with communities that sound to work better than the ones I've been in, and I asked him what he thought was the variable that made a community work, and he said that it stops working as soon as any individual within the community stops working on themselves. So that I thought was a very interesting statement, because I think it's genuinely little realized that dispute resolution, that actually sorting out difficulties we have between ourselves, is fundamentally an aspect of personal development. It's not something outside ourselves at all. And each time we manage to deal peacefully with either our own or somebody else's jealousy or anger or greed or whatever it is, then we make a little bit of progress, and hopefully so does the other individual, but that doesn't really matter, because the only one we've in the end got responsibility for is ourselves. And it seems to me to be really bizarre that we should even be having to think about this stuff, really, because it's so much easier for all of us if we approach everything with just a little bit more care. Because there are actually massive advantages to be had from sharing a community lifestyle. It means that we can share kit and tackle. It's amazing how it reduces the costs to us of actually living in this rather strange society. And it's not just the financial cost that it reduces either. It can reduce a lot of the stress as work and burden is shared. But also there's, I think, other ways in which it works really well. One of the things that's happened to me really, I guess, especially over the last 10 years, is that less and less work is being done in exchange for cash, such as it's called. And more of it's being done for, I don't know what we'd call it really, social capital, I guess. Round here, more and more people are finding themselves in voluntary work. And there's a little bit of me that looks at that and thinks, well, it's not exactly right, is it? But then there's another bit of me that looks at it and says, well, if the money isn't real, we're kind of volunteering anyway. And maybe this movement is a movement that, that we'll all be able to take advantage of. The thing is that if you can reduce how much you need to earn, then you can reduce the amount of work you need to do. You can reduce the amount of tax that's being taken off you. All sorts of hidden benefits become apparent. And each of those things that are more easily shared reduce all manner of other stresses. They actually give people the time they need to start developing their own projects and the like. And it's amazing how ingenious people can be once a little bit of the pressure is removed. And the single most easy way, I think, of reducing the amount of money we need to earn, cash we need to earn, is to be cooperating openly with other people. It means that the more of us are doing that, the more of other people's waste, stuff that they might want to take down the tip, is available, is more likely to be useful for people that are around you. Money, actual cash, well, you know what I mean by cash, those paper notes, the promises to pay that we hand around. They can be kept moving around a small community and do loads and loads and loads of work without ever finding their way into a bank, which is a place where I don't think we should ever put that folding money. There's also the opportunity when you're working together to choose where you put your money, which I think is another thing that's really vital. Is round here we still have a lot of, although they are disappearing, we have a lot of old style family businesses, which means that we have the ability further to move the gaming tokens around locally, and spending the money there gets us a better service without a doubt than we'd normally get from modern these out of town sheds. And it also means that there's a bunch of expertise that is being kept in a job. I find it really great to see places around here that are that have got the same people working in them as were here 20 years ago when I first arrived. And it's really got to be a sign that people are being treated properly and paid properly to do their jobs. And it does mean that we can take like a bundle of broken bits into a place and go, hey, I got one of these and it did this and I want to do this with it. And we'll get the right bits and the right information. Not a shopping experience that everybody necessarily enjoys nowadays. So keeping our money floating around our own communities, I think, is also really vital, what money there is. And before everything comes the idea, I think probably the most important thing we need to be able to do is realise that the potential for working together is actually there. I don't think it's ever been more important than it is now. And I was moved and cheered to a great extent by the people that I met and talked to this morning. Because I feel that at last we might be starting to see some moves in that direction. So I'm going to play a couple of tunes. Don't forget you can call in on dr.rock2012 on Skype. Or, like I say, get me a phone number and I can call you. I think at the moment we're going to have some Doctor and the Medics. Why not? And you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on raconteursnews.com. That was Dexter Dextrous and his Fingersmiths, and That's Life. And I think the time for saying that's feckin' life, as it were, is past. It's time for us to stand up and address some of the things that are going. I think we're probably going to be joined by Unique Lee shortly. In fact, I'll just try and give him a quick bell while he's in there now. So hopefully that will work. Hi there, Lee. How you doing, mate?
Greetings, Doctor.
Excellent. Looks like you're coming through loud and clear. I'm sure they'll let us know if they can only hear one half of us in the chat box. Thanks very much for joining me, mate. I appreciate it.
Well, you're asking for a bit of help, aren't you, at the moment, with some contextual conversation. So I thought, yeah, why not?
Yeah, that's really
good. Give the good Doc a ring.
Yeah, we like a bit of collaborative conversation.
Yeah.
I'm feeling pretty optimistic at the moment, as you've noticed, and so it's probably really good that we got the dark side of the room on to join us. What do you think, mate? Do you think there's any chance of us starting to get community back together again?
As long as we start talking to each other, yeah, absolutely. Mm. Are we live, yeah?
Yeah, we are, yeah.
Oh, right, okay, so
yeah,
I did.
Yeah, we're going. Yeah,
greetings to Raconteurs News listeners. I would say so, yeah, because when I'm having conversations in the real world in college, just a bit of, you know, background, I'm doing carpentry third year, and you'll find 75% of the class will be interested in some of the subject matter, but they're still giving you that skeptical look, you know. And yeah, you'll have that 5% that are really interested.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that you give the websites to, and you give information like, oh, go to Raconteurs News, oh, go to Chuck O'Chelly, or, you know, go and see this and that site, that wherever we prefer. But you can usually guide people from there and say, if you're interested in this, there's a bigger circle for you if you go here as a hub first, and then make some new contacts.
And are you finding any of those people are making progress under this sort of guidance?
Well, they approached me back in Collins saying, oh, yeah, I got in contact with what you were telling about. And, yeah, interesting stuff, isn't it? It's like, you know, this is what we're doing. Just explore. See where you feel you'll get pulled.
Yep. It's one of the things I think that's most important to bear in mind is that people don't realise there's anything that can be done. Whereas one of the things, of course, we've been learning about is how to engage with authorities, how to try and start holding people to account, which is what the guys at the school meeting I was at earlier really need to know, I think.
Mm-hmm.
They're looking at drawing people together. Because we've got a particularly predatory council here in Powys. I think because we've got about the lowest population per capita.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's probably being used as a bit of a laboratory to find out what happens when you close loads of schools and try and open up one big super school. I mean, is that kind of thing happening around you?
Yeah, there's test balloons everywhere.
Mm.
That's what I generally call them now, test balloons, just to see if they can get it passed unnoticed and unchallenged by people. You know, is the technology working where they're just not paying attention anymore and we can do what they like? And it would appear that they do, and they can.
Yes, but it does at least appear that people are noticing now.
Yeah, because funny you should say this. I had a conversation with the guy who owns the garage next door. He had an electricity company wanting to gain access into his dwelling, and it was his landlord or his lettings agents. Just, you know, they didn't ask him. It was like, you know, this guy's, they're coming around through this survey or this whatever it be. And then while he was telling me this, he's like, well, you should be ringing your landlord or your lettings agent or whoever and orally telling them, oh, no, you're not. You haven't given me sufficient notice. Number one, you haven't asked my permission anyway. You're just assuming you can just break into my dwelling anyway without any merit to my risk. Said, have you done a risk assessment before they even arrive at your house? And he said, well, what do you mean, Lee? I said, well, you could leave a broken glass bottle on the front. You know, as people walk in, you might be a bit maniacal. You could leave booby traps, you know, when someone opens the front door and they get an axe in their head. Have they done a risk assessment before they come to your dwelling? He went, no. I said, put that in writing. Stall them as long as you can by making them jump through your hoops, because it's your dwelling and you're in control there.
Yes, which people, of course, just don't realize, but it's
it's your sacred space. It's your office in a technical sense. That's where you can really truly operate from in a private capacity always. As soon as you leave your front doorstep, you're in the public eye. You're in a different realm.
Yes.
Yeah? You would understand that? Yeah.
Yeah.
Or is that a bit me being a bit weird?
No, it's completely correct. I think there's definitely a difference between what goes on within your own gates and what happens when you get out into the wider world. And
yeah,
this, of course, is the interesting challenge, because the thing that's really brought community to mind today is realizing that actually these people are going to be trying to form a working community, lots and lots of different people from lots of backgrounds, and that it seems to me some of the work that needs to be done is not only about addressing the schools and stuff, but actually addressing each other and making sure that the work that's being done can be carried forward, that people aren't going to fall out with each other.
Yeah, there's a wonderful side effect to that too as well, as I'm finding. We have this big argument to save our NHS, don't we?
Yeah, we do.
I'm the complete antithesis to that. I'm like, no. To be honest, I would rather let that fall because it's all privately owned. And it's, let's face it, they're paying rent to those buildings now. They're not even publicly free. They're paying rentage, honey, a rent charge. So what I say to people is, go natural. Get your friend. I mean, my girlfriend, she makes balms and oils and ailments, you know, ointments, whatever it be, tinctures. And she will offer them out if people require them. You know, she'll say, well, I'm not a doctor. It's take it at your own kind of merit, but give me an idea of what you're looking for to be treated for, and I'll make it a little tincture or a balm. And generally speaking, she gets positive results every time. Therefore, we're divesting the energy away from that system that's harming people back into the community our way. At least we're sharing our knowledge, say, this is what you can do without that. You don't need the shampoos. You don't need the perfumes. You can do it all naturally. And we can help you, you know, distribute that and empower one another rather than go into boots.
Yes, and I think that's a really important way to start is with people's health, because it is one of the places where not only can we do things for ourselves, but so many times, I mean, my own personal experience is that the Not Healthy service has not really done me any favours at all, and that in all cases, I've actually found resolution to quite serious and, you know, long-standing problems using exactly the techniques that you've discovered, that you're describing.
Yeah.
And really, it's that kind of change of mind that needs to be encouraged, isn't it? Is to give people these kind of small discoveries to start with.
Absolutely. It is word of mouth still. I mean, again, it's communication when you have a conversation with people. And even though my girlfriend has kind of like the same wavelength as me, you know, she's of the kind of mind because, you know, obviously we're boyfriend, girlfriend, and she wouldn't be with a nutter if she didn't kind of agree with some of the stuff I give off on the dark side. But she's the same. She will communicate with people. Invariably, 5 out of 10 people will dismiss her. But that's 50%. The other 5 will listen. The other 5 will, you know, accept her gift. And it may or may not, it generally does, but it will bring them back to her and say, when you make some more of that, can I have a bit more? You know, I'll buy some off you next time. So again, she's getting to this idea where she gives it for free for people to test, and if it works, they offer her something.
Yes.
Whatever, even if it covers the cost of making it and a little bit more for her time, there's a little bit of negotiation and bartering happening privately.
Yeah. And individual to individual. Relationship complete with, you know, with eye contact and all the pheromones and everything.
It's trust as well. I mean, we're dealing with people's health, but she's getting very good now with, you know, what I'm giving her with how people's bodies operate and what they truly need to keep it working in a very, functional manner, shall we say, without all the poisons and toxins. She's also giving them the beneficial reasons why she's making it for them. So she gets as much feedback as what a doctor would, you know, in a private capacity. But it's trust.
Yes.
There's a lot of trust to this as well, because she doesn't want to give her two, you know, things that are bad for her skin. She doesn't want to give them too alkaline. So she has to know what she's doing, and she also needs the trust of the other to sample and be a kind of guinea pig in a way. But it's part of it. There's trust.
Yeah, it's certainly the case. And I mean, that's, I think, one aspect of the changes that I'm seeing is that I've been, for 20 years or so, I've been involved with complementary medicine because I found that it works, but I'm seeing lots and lots more people now. And the thing is that this is another interesting dynamic, I think, is that the health service is being, as you say, heavily privatized. It's all under the private finance initiative. So it's got massive, massive debts. They've already not got enough doctors and are trying to spread the ones they've got even thinner. Round here, people can actually wait 7 or 8 days before they get to see a GP. And in some cases, the situation is so urgent that they actually have to go to see somebody else. And again, we know a lady who was taken into hospital for an urgent operation because everything had got blocked up inside.
Mm-hmm.
And they said to her, they said, we haven't got an anaesthetist. You'll have to go home. And she'd been sent in as an emergency. So she looked at a liver and gallbladder cleanse and sorted it all out herself in the time between, you know, when they could actually see her and, the present. And then went to her doctor and said, hey, look, it's completely gone. We don't need to do anything at all. And
yeah.
He wasn't able for some reason to spread that information.
Yeah, this is kind of why we did what we did with my mother. Just quickly, and I think you're aware that she had what's called non-cell lung carcinoma, or non-small cell lung carcinoma, which is basically a very small lung cancer tumor. Mm-hmm. Now, we went through the process of using the National Harm Service pretty much against my own wishes, but again, my mother's the patient and it's her wishes, so we have to support her. Now, we'd done our own research on the radiography and the radiation itself and how much she was going to be given, which was good because he was pretty open with that. At least he described why he was giving her the doses he was giving her. So the NHS isn't all crippled yet. There is still some good people there who, you know, will not fight you on certain things. I mean, with us, we told him we were giving her cannabis oil. We told him we were giving her CBD oil. And he didn't fight it. He said, look, if you want to continue doing that privately, be my guest. I'm not a cannabis expert. I'm a radiographer.
Yeah.
That's my profession. What you want to do topically outside is great, but the point is when we went back there after all the scans, it had reduced from 27 millimeters down to such a small scale he actually couldn't pick it up microscopically.
What did he think of that?
Let's just say his words were, it's shrunken, and then a long pause. I think I would love to have seen his case files. I mean, I don't want to perk into his private practice, but I would love to see his general standard expectation of every time he's done that amount of radiation and his expected outcome of how big or how small it may or may not have reduced. And I'll guarantee you that one stuck out like a sore thumb because it went. It pretty much disappeared. And I guarantee you his other patient didn't have that reaction when they had that amount of radiation. I think that's what stunned them.
Yeah, indeed. And they get to see spontaneous remissions as well, don't they? It's actually one of the places where I choose to start with people who use the slide response, because the NHS, frankly, is one of the places where you can start a big fight really quickly. It's actually a classic example of what I was talking about earlier when I said that people aren't treating each other with kind of mutual compassion and respect. And some of the things you say just make people really angry. And to criticize the NHS is one of those things.
Yeah, what was interesting with this doc before we go into the NHS, quickly just to round this one up, the reason why I told you that story is no one believed that my mother was going to get better, because where she lives, everyone who gets cancer goes through the whole suffrage thing. They'll do the radiotherapy, then they'll do the chemotherapy, then the whole family will just get all around it until the deathbed, you know, within 2.5 years of them having the so-called treatment. Now, my mother's going to go out there and see all these people, and they're going to go, how are you? And she's going to go, I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine. Now, she goes to bingo. The bingo's a big place for the birds to sing, yeah?
Yeah.
Because they're all potential cancer victims. Every single one of them's an obesity problem. Seriously, my hometown is literally being bitten by the obesity vampire, and they're all victims of it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all unhealthily large. And now she can go into a place like that where my mother knows everyone, and they'll say, how did you do it? And she'll say, it was the cannabis oil specifically.
Yeah.
Because that doctor knows it. And I've got we record it. If you'd like to hear it one day of him actually telling my mother that her cancer has virtually disappeared, you can have it. Because I have documented proof now that if it wasn't the radiotherapy, then what was it?
Yeah.
But it's also one of these other things we looked into, because radiotherapy can be used concomitantly with CBD oil or cannabis oil, and it can be beneficial. It can actually help, which is why we tolerated and said, okay, we'll go along with your mother, but we still don't like the idea of it, because you're putting radiation inside you.
Yeah.
So we needed to get all the antioxidants in there while she's being treated, while she's being punished. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just pushed it with everything while she was being radiated with more antioxidants and positive ions to get rid of the negative ions the treatment's causing. So it's just an understanding of knowledge. So she can go out to the world now and not know what we know, but just say, it wasn't just the radiotherapy. There's other things you have to do to get through this. You don't want just 2.5 years extra life. This can be reversed.
Yeah.
Not cured, reversed.
This is one of the things, you see, I think that is very common in the heads that believe that we need to be governed, is that they're completely missing how important individual decisions are and how effective they can be, how natural ways of doing things kind of arise around us once we start talking to each other. We don't need to be governed, because given a bit of freedom, we can manage it ourselves.
It's fear. It really is fear. My mother was terrified of not doing the things we were asking her to do. She relied purely on the medical system and that white coat.
Yes.
She did. Yeah. She was the biggest battle to convince to do what we asked her to do. She didn't understand why. She refused all of it, pretty much, until we said, look, either you do this and change your lifestyle, or you're going to end up like most of your friends. And we don't really want that. You can change this, but it's your mindset that has to change, not mine, not my brother's, yours. And when she had that first scan and she started seeing things, then everything's changed. Now her mindset's changed, because now she understands.
Yeah. Yeah. I got a quote in this, the Reinventing Organizations book, which says, ultimately it comes down to this. Fear is a great inhibitor. When organizations or communities are built on, not on implicit mechanisms of fear, but on structures and practices that breed trust and responsibility, extraordinary and unexpected things start to happen.
Well, two things branch out from this for a start. Number one, people now have faith and a bit more trust in what an old, you know, an old well-known woman that they sort of, I think, you know, have demonstrated that it's not the end of the road. When someone says, oh, I'm sorry, but you've got cancer. That's the start of it. That's not the end. That's when you get the kick up the bum and it's like, well, now it's time to change.
Yeah.
So we're not going to form communities and cooperations if people are dying too soon and relying on this National Harm Service to cure your ills. It's not going to happen. No matter how much money you plow into that system, it's not designed to heal you. Mm. It just isn't. The drugs that they sell tell me it's not. And I couldn't really invest in that, because the first thing I want to do is remove all of them and get natural substances in there, like intravenous vitamin C.
Yes. Yeah, and many other simple approaches that seem to work really well.
Yeah, cannabis oil, CBD oil, whatever works that we know factually works. You need to remove these drugs and replace it with what does work. Like case law, if that case law proves that's a precedent that you should follow as a standard for every other judge after you, then things like that should be precedent, regardless of what pharmaceutical companies say.
Well, exactly right. I mean, one of the things that's interested me about the health service generally is that we know that on average, placebos will work 30% of the time, and that in some specialties, they actually work 70% of the time. And yet I don't see any money going into research in placebos.
No. I mean, the other thing we found really interesting was this substance called artemisinin.
We've not heard of that one.
No, it's, you know, Artemis, the goddess. Well, it's named after that, artemisinin. But under studies there, on its own as an extract, again, it's one of these South American plants, I believe, but what they were saying is under studies with people who had cancers of all kinds, not just lung cancer, but, you know, just cancer in general, it reduced them by 27% as an extract alone. 27%, which is a huge amount, you know, just on its own. But when they mixed it with iron as a concomitant compound, it reduced it by 97%, specifically lung cancer.
Wow.
So we popped that into it before she had a scan, 2 weeks before. We managed to get 2 weeks worth of artemisinin into her before she had the next scan. And she couldn't have a PET scan because she's allergic to the radium they inject into you, you know, the blue dye.
Yeah.
That gave her hives.
Right.
But putting that into it, I don't know whether that helped towards the end, because we just thought we'd batter it with everything we thought we could put into a system that was, you know, without any extra toxic. You know, some things can be a bit more toxic when you release, you know, too much too soon. So we really had to balance what we gave her at certain critical times to make sure this all worked when it should have. You know?
Yeah.
So again, it's just trial and error, a lot of it.
And of course, one of the questions that is frequently asked about this is, well, if there's all this stuff working against cancer, why aren't we being told about it?
I suppose this is why word of mouth and visible evidence is better. You know, if she's still walking around when she shouldn't be, don't you think that's going to make people think, well, how did she do it?
I do, especially if they're aware that, you know, in 1939 somebody passed an act which forbade anybody to talk about anything apart from, you know, radiotherapy, chemotherapy or surgery in this regard.
Yeah. I mean, it depends how you define chemotherapy. I mean, this is one thing we looked at as an alternative route was if we couldn't successfully do what we needed to do and then the doctors suddenly turn around and say, well, okay, Mrs. So-and-so, that didn't work, so we need to go to chemotherapy. I would have suggested to him, okay, we'll do chemotherapy, but my choice of chemotherapy drug is intravenous vitamin C, 100 grams per day for 2 weeks. Let's start with that. Because I'm not denying you chemotherapy treatment. I'm not going to go against your wishes, but you're choosing the drug. I'm choosing the drug, not you. Yeah. I'm going to class it as a chemotherapy drug because I know it will be chemotherapy. What's the word for it? It's a chematic or something. Chematological.
Chemotherapeutic.
It will do what you think you're going to do with radiation. Now, this isn't the question of whether you believe that's true or not. You don't have authority to override my wishes.
So effectively, your mum will be building, hopefully, a community around herself of people who develop alternative interests. And I see this thing as kind of connected with the schools, because we've got a problem where, obviously, the smaller schools have been closing for ages. We've still got some really, really sweet little schools out here.
Yeah.
But now what they've chosen to do is close most of the secondary schools, and they've got an imaginary plan to build a new one, but they don't know where they're going to put it and stuff like that. But that's giving people a lot of reasons for coming together. But what's very strange is that a lot of the people are also realizing that the education system is about as effective for education as the health system is for health. So they find themselves at one and the same time, fighting to keep the schools open at the same time as developing doubts as to whether these places are where they actually want their offspring to go, which must be really difficult.
Well, they've kind of created exactly what they were supposed to do, and that's competition within schools. They put them on these point scoring systems. I mean, they set schools against each other, which is why you got the selective process of going to so-called good schools and so-called low-performing schools. They've just tricked everyone into believing there's a choice and there's a hierarchy to it all. I mean, yes. You don't even get a standard, you know, comprehensive, like we used to in the 80s. There was a so-called comprehensive, you know, it was comprehensive. In other words, it was all-encompassing, which everyone was already templated with that the year before you.
Yeah.
As you get indoctrinated, it's comprehensive.
Yeah.
You don't get that now. You've got points-based star systems where it's all about investment and how much the shares are making. That's not what school's about. They've been hijacked too.
Yes, they have. And I think, again, people are kind of realizing this, which is it's kind of bringing the bigger picture home to people, I think, making them more likely to start questioning what's happening to them.
Well, I don't remember reading in any of these manifestos when these so-called members of parliament that are entrusted to do your will, I don't remember them saying in the sub-clauses, oh, you've got the right to a good education and a free education, allegedly, but we didn't promise you that you actually go to the one where you live. You know, the closest one that's possible to make it easier for you. No, we didn't say we'd do that. You're going to get sent to one of our choosing. Now, if people are willing to put up with that in the case of their children, because they're going to grow up in that system as it is now, never mind if it gets any worse, look at your kids and say, do I want to imprint that onto my kids' future at this time of their life? What else can possibly come after this? You know, because I don't see it abating.
No, and I mean, and on that basis, surely it would be, I think it's got to be worth looking at the kind of communities that are forming to try and address these problems and see if they can't be made strong enough to start doing the other thing, really, which I suppose is kind of educating your own children or offspring or however it goes. But I'd really love to take advantage of what's happening to see if we can't, because in the end, we're going to have to replace what we've got from the ground up, aren't we, if it's going to do anything at all.
I think we've been so far removed from our natural instincts and our nature that just imagine if you were a lioness and you had, I don't know, a leopard or something creeping up on your pup. Would you just sit there and go, I know there's a pedophile teacher in the school, but it's okay. There's police, you know, there's legislation for that. Yeah, I know she's getting taught child pornography in schools through UNESCO and the United Nations, through agreements with the UK government, but it's okay. I know she's in school. She's getting educated. Yeah, and I've got a fingerprint ID to get access to my own child and pick her up at some future time, but it's okay. She's getting educated. It's free. And I'm sitting there going, are you people realizing if you were in the nature, you would have seen someone's predatory stalking your child? You'd already be on your feet going, what's this game? Wouldn't you?
You would.
You're creeping towards my child here. Oh, my pup. Oh, dad. You know, you'd be sending the line off, wouldn't you? You'd be sending the father over. But we don't do that. We just let it encroach even more till they will probably hold your kids hostage and say, well, can you prove who you are?
Yeah, they say.
Are you the biological entity that owns this child right now? No, it's going to be like a bond where you release your child into their possession and you might pay a fee and then they'll release it back like you're on bail. Your kids are on bail to you for the weekend. That's where I see this is going.
It's kind of how it works, because one of the first things I read when I came to Mid Wales was that the county council and various authorities had done a truancy sweep of a local town and were shocked to discover that 60% of the children found out of school were... quote, caught with their parents.
Oh my God, how terrible is that?
Yeah, it's dreadful, isn't it?
Oh no.
But a friend of ours wanted to take her offspring out of school because she wanted to go abroad for, I think it was 3 months. And she was actually told by somebody she knew who used to be in senior management in the education authority that what you needed to do is write a letter that deregisters the child from the school. Then you can take him away and register him when he comes back again. Which showed quite a level of recognition, I thought.
I'm just getting a nice little message from Madrin in the chat there. We were talking about cancer before. He's just said that, yeah, he's just passed a 5-year remission mark. Now that's fantastic news. I mean, that's one of those, 100,000, one in 100,000 cases, that one.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. They tend to measure it in people who survive 2 years, don't they?
2 years to 5 years, but 5 years being the maximum. And if he's past that, then yeah, there's a nice statistic for us tonight.
Yeah. Well, human body and human beings are incredibly resilient, it seems to be.
Yeah. We've had few diseases and things try and wipe us out in the past, but for some reason, the human body does develop some kind of weird immunities to certain things. So it does give you some kind of, you know, what's the word? A reprieve from being stinked.
It has a lot of fantastic systems in it, which if stimulated rather than suppressed, do a fabulous job, I think.
If only we understood fully what we could do, you know, without being toxified.
Yes. Yeah. And we, I suspect we don't have much knowledge of that. I mean, I was talking to a lady today who's renting a house. I think she said 15 minutes away from a garbage incinerator.
Mm.
And she says that, you know, they're burning a lot of plastic, and she said that they told her it was safe. And did I think it was? And I said, well, orthodoxy will have you believe that it is completely safe because it's got these excellent filters on it. But unorthodoxy might suggest that the particles that are coming out of it are thus so fine that, your body doesn't actually have the ability to filter them.
Nope.
And whilst it might be helpful to be upwind and 15 minutes away, it's probably better than being close to it and downwind, but all of these things are relative. But if you approach your body knowing that's what's going on, then I'd be tempted to, you know, adopt a few detoxing practices and things like that.
Yeah, the biggest scare story out there is too much sugar. Like I was trying to explain to my girlfriend, it's not the sugar that's the problem. Okay, white sugar is a poison. We get that, but it's not the sugar that's giving you fat. It's not the fatty foods that are giving you the fat problem. It's the synthesized sugars like aspartame, the one I don't like.
Saccharin.
Mm. It's those artificial sweeteners that your body just can't synthesize into anything else but fat cells.
Yeah.
It just pumps it into adipose tissue and it stays there.
Yeah.
It can't synthesize it at all. That's your problem.
And it's food for cancer.
That's food for cancer because you can't get rid of it unless you exercise and, you know, let it release fully. But that means you've got to starve for it to be released and broken down into, you know, what is it, collagen and other things it does, glucogen. Yeah. It breaks down naturally, but you've got to starve. You've got to start doing your body something to start releasing it and breaking it down. but you don't see it.
No, and I think the same is true probably of white flour and refined everything, because we're basically systems for refining food into gross food into subtle energy.
Yeah, their idea of clean food is to have everything inert and have no trace minerals or elements of anything. Mm. That's their idea of clean.
Well, Synchro has started fermenting foods, so we have kimchi and sauerkraut and kombucha. And all of these things are, of course, alive. So, and that we realized is practically a revolutionary act. And yet it's one that's been developed by, I gather, every single society there's been has developed a fermented food of some sort because it is so good for us.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big problem is if we start looking back into history, we're just completely outside of the garden. We've got no fruit.
No.
We've got artificial versions of it all, sadly.
Yep. Yes, indeed, and it's very difficult to grow your own soil, although we are finding we're looking back at Lawrence Hill's organic gardening bible, really, for this year's growing, and we're finding lots of vegetables and fruits that he actually recommended all those years ago are still available, so we're getting them this year and concentrating on saving the seed. Because it seems to me that the good, honest heritage varieties do work a lot better, but you've got to work hard on feeding your soil if you're going to get nutrients into the food.
Well, it's the same with, again, my girlfriend just took the time to, she just moved and got herself a nice little backyard, but it's already planted. You know, the pots are in. She got herself some fertilizer, some food, and she's planted already.
Yeah.
So what I would say to people, if they've got any kind of land or, you know, curtilage at the back of their properties that can occupy even pot plants, you know, pop some spuds in there.
Yeah.
It'll grow.
And encourage other people to do it as well, because, and once again, the more people there are growing, the more food there is to kind of hand out amongst yourselves, and it's much, much better for you.
Well, I used to give my neighbours me peas, and he'd throw me down some onions. You know, he was growing different things. His other side, he was doing like carrots and onions, and I think he was doing runner beans, and I was doing spuds and carrots. And then we just swap. You know, I'd take some up and see, you know. But that's the way we worked. You know, what are you growing this year? Well, I'm going to try some of these. All right, you try them and I'll try this.
That's the way. That's one of the things, I think, is that at the moment there's a tendency in people to believe they need to compete, whereas in fact cooperating is all round a much better idea.
Well, it's pointless both of us just planting spuds.
Right? Yeah.
No point.
Yeah.
Spuds will last you for, you know, one big spud will feed you for a, you know, plate of chips or,
yeah.
You know, you can do a lot with that, but you'd like some other vegetables to go with it.
I think once you know your vegetables as well, you get to realize which ones are going to be really productive. So, courgettes tend to turn out kind of more food than a family can eat, and so do, runner beans. So if one of you grows courgettes and the other one grows runner beans, then there's more room for swapsies.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, each food's got its own amount of yield, hasn't it? You know, and then it depends if they're big or small, whether the weather's been kind to it or not. So yeah, there's a couple of risks of growing different foods, but it's not impossible for people to start. I mean, this is pretty much the season now, isn't it? Starting to break it. I think it's a month out. What do you think?
Here it seems to be running pretty much true to form, I reckon. The flowers are maybe a bit late, but the hawthorn came out early.
Yeah.
Our problem over recent years has been that the April and May has been really good, and then it's just got totally wet and cold in June. I'm hoping that doesn't happen this year, but we've always had some success. You know, some crops suffer, others do really well under those conditions.
Yeah, it's been hit and miss for me for the last 3 years with me spuds, I've got to admit.
Yeah, we're growing spuds in bags this year, and in all of our own compost to try and kind of keep the blight at bay. I really love potatoes, but people say there's no point in growing them, but they're one of my favourites, they are.
Oh, they are. Yeah, from your own soil they are.
Yeah. So this business of people getting together, do you think, to start with, that it's inevitable that conflicts are going to arise between people who are trying to do complex stuff together?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I would say that because the entire system is competition based.
Yeah. So I would agree with you there that whatever it is you set yourself up to try and do, conflicts are going to arise between people for all sorts of personal and organizational reasons. So it seems to me to be important that one of the first things you do if you're going to start cooperating with somebody is make sure you have a means of sorting out disputes.
That's one part of it. I think the other thing is dragging people away into a way of thinking where they do have more control than they perceive.
Yeah.
Because I don't know whether you encounter this, but people say, oh, I just couldn't do that. Mm. It's like, you can. You just got to exert your will a little bit.
Yeah. It's mostly fear that makes people not want to try things, isn't it?
Sadly, it is. But, you know, with the likes of yourself and me and anyone else who's doing this kind of thing, we're always pushing people to say, don't be fearful, just do it. We'll deal with the consequences after if there is any for what you're doing. But look at what you need to do. Don't worry about what you think other people are going to think about it.
Yeah, do what you deem to be necessary.
Yeah, if it's honourable and you don't see any harm in it, then don't think it should be feared.
No, I. The other thing that struck me is that I've noticed it before and talked about it at festivals, that we always have to have a large rubbish recycling team.
Mm-hmm.
And in the meantime, there's a large team of people that are just dropping stuff on the ground. And I tried to say, you know, if there weren't a load of people dropping stuff on the ground, then we could save a lot of time. And there seems to me to be an awful lot of that going on as well.
Yeah.
People making unnecessary work for other people and maybe seeing things that need to be done and just walking by them rather than having a go.
Yeah. I try and harken back to the good old days of that gentlemanly character, you know, the one who used to walk down the road with his walking cane and tip his hat to the ladies and open doors and be chivalrous.
Yeah.
We just can't even do that on a simple, basic level without us behaving like animals.
It would appear so. It has been my most difficult recognition, I think, over these last 5 or 6 years. That has.
I don't blame people. I don't. It's just the system that we've had fomented for us for over 1,000 years. I mean, let's be conservative.
Yeah,
it's a long time to be brainwashed. It is. I don't expect people to wake from this nightmare overnight. I don't. But it's coming slowly. That's all. Very slowly.
Well, it certainly is. But, I mean, this is one of the things that the people I was talking to today, I was saying that that when people feel that the man is coming knocking on their door or working to their disadvantage, that is the point at which people start becoming aware of what's going on. That means more or less by definition that the harder the system squeezes, the more people are going to become aware and potentially active as a result, which is why in the end empire nearly always fails. Rome's still with us, but not for long, I don't think.
Mm. I try and analyze it by using this mental picture. Most people would generally agree that slavery ended kind of in America first, didn't it?
Yeah.
Allegedly. And then we'd already been free already in England. But I say to people, how long was everyone in slavery before that point? How long back in time were they all under either an autocracy, a tyranny, despots, dictators, mass murderers, genocidal leaders? How many thousands of years did that system exist before you all think it ended in the 1800s?
Yeah.
Talk about mind control. It's like Alice in Wonderland. You think you've left Wonderland, but you're still there. You're still in that slave system. You just don't see it.
Yes, that was one of the things the lady that had a go at me earlier on in the week said, was she said that if we don't vote, we'll get anarchy, and Plato says that after anarchy, you get tyranny. And I said, well, I think we've got tyranny already. And she said, no, we haven't, and had another go.
Yeah, but Plato also liked the idea of slaves not having wristbands, so they'll know they're slaves. Yeah,
yes.
I don't take his philosophy too much to heart.
No, I think there's probably more modern sources we could be looking at now.
You never get the Platonist using that one against you, do you? You know, they'll quote Plato, but when you quote it back to them, that one specific one, they go, yeah, but look at Republic. It's like, yeah, the Zionists done the same in somewhere else in history. Yeah, I see the pattern.
There's another subject that gets you into loads of trouble straight away.
Well, I mean, if you're going to bring Plato up as some kind of argument as, this aristocratic idea that slavery is okay.
Yeah.
Then you're going to fail big time with that quote that he says, don't give them wristbands. Don't know the slaves. Can't be doing that.
People
think you don't read these things, you know. They all think you're daft and like, oh, he's not educated. He reads the Daily Fail. No, we read this shit. We don't know how to startle and all that.
Well, I mean, these things really fire up. It's the way I used to write essays when I was at college, was I used to go and find somebody else who'd written about what I was after reading. But I've found somebody who made me angry and with whom I disagreed. And it generally led to really, really cracking essays, which is another thing about people relating with other people, is that you don't realize what you're thinking until you communicate honestly and calmly with somebody who thinks differently.
If I was going to categorize myself, I would say I'm a philosopher. I mean, I've been seeking knowledge and wisdom most of my life. It's probably the best title I'll accept, you know, because it's a neutral position. I'm just seeking knowledge.
Yes, and has it
been more, nothing less?
And has it been that way with you for as long as you can remember?
Since I was about 4, I think.
Mm. Yeah, I became aware that a lot of the things I was reading when I was a youngster, like at junior school, apparently, I did a big project on the planets, and I did a big project on the history of the police force. That's in like junior school, at pre-11 or whatever. I have the suspicion that we are kind of here on a mission, and that we're kind of equipped with drives that that lead us where we need to go. And that, again, obviously is a really useful thing to actually believe, because it makes you a lot more positive in the way you interact with whatever it is that's happening.
Well, this is why I always kind of think that, you know, you hear these sophistry diktats like, you know thyself. All these wonderful little quotations by all these learned elders.
Great idea. How do I do that?
Yeah. But I think that does come into action when you start thinking about, well, when I was 4, bearing in mind I had no religious family, you know, not that I recall, was never influenced in that way. But I was asking questions of myself while I was in dreamland, saying to myself, well, this blackness that I see every night I close my eyes, is this the last thing I'm going to see when I die? You know, where's the light?
Yeah.
Now, I'm 4 years of age. Why am I asking myself that question? Because I remember vividly asking myself, because I was in that void for ages until I found this light and I got out of it. But that was 4 years of age, and I thought, well, there's more to this than meets the eye, obviously.
Well, there is, I think, quite a valid school of thought which suggests that that those of us who are still not yet 7 years of age are actually more closely connected with source and the real nature of things than the world we're conditioned to eventually recognize.
The funny thing is, I'm not alone. My girlfriend had exactly the same thing when she was exactly the same age, exactly the same position, asking the same questions. Isn't that spooky?
Well,
same place, just couldn't find the light.
No, these are special times, and I mean, I think that that's a fair allegory, isn't it? It is very difficult to find the light, and the harder you look for it, the more it seems not to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But the reason I said that was because even though looking back now retrospectively, it's a strange question to ask yourself when you're 4. And then I realise, well, let's investigate myself a little bit more and find out, well, am I a bit different than everyone else? Do I think differently? You know, am I maybe wired differently? And apparently when children have had meningitis, meningococcal, like I had, and let's just say you come closer to where I came from. I mean, I basically came into this realm upside down with the umbilical cord wrapped around my throat. With scurvy, severe vitamin C deficiency.
No wonder you come up with the radio show you did.
Yeah. And meningitis, meningococcal septicemia, which was lovely. But again, my doctor cured me in the 70s. He cured me with intravenous vitamin C.
So it was
ascorbic acid and meningitis, meningococcal, the septicemic version, vitamin C, intravenously.
I didn't.
Two things I know about.
Yeah. That's a recognised thing even then, the vitamin C.
Yeah, but the reason why I say that is when I look studies on people who have had meningitis, meningococcal, and autism, or, you know, someone who's slightly autistic or a bit strange, apparently 1 in 5 ends up slightly autistic.
Right, which is recognised by some to being as being a special kind of attention.
However that wants to be defined, but I just thought it was a curious, you know, statistic that, I mean, am I the 1 in 5? You know, compared to most people I speak to, am I that 1 in 5 autistic-like guy that, you know, is wired a bit differently because he came upside down, crashed into the bins, you know, and I was seriously lacking in vitamin C. So, I don't know what that would do to a human neuron chain.
Every single thing that happens to us is what makes us unique, isn't it?
Don't come into this world upside down, kids. It's not fun.
No, well, I was, they had to come in after me. I kept turning round and sticking my legs up and just refusing to come out. So in the end, I was from my mother's womb untimely ripped, as the man said. Do you think that one of the reasons why, I mean, there seems to be, a thought in the administration that men and women somehow need to be protected from facts. All manner of stuff is closed. The books are closed. All manner of information isn't available. It seems to me that one of the things that we need to encourage in budding communities is that that is not the case, that we, that everybody has access to all the information that's available rather than some people having preferential access. And I think it's another really important point.
Yeah, I'm not really into people being gatekeepers and, I've got this if you give me this for a fee. You know, this is what I've hated about the internet from the beginning. I always wanted the internet to remain as a digital version of the Library of Alexandria, where we could tap in just to the information, to the knowledge.
Yeah.
It should never have become a consumer hub that it's become. It's basically become the new digital bank. You know, this is the new cash machine right in front of you.
It's digital everything, isn't it? Digital gambling, digital cash.
And we've allowed it. We've allowed it to not be a book. But it's become a shop.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what happened. Now, I would love to sweep that back and say, okay, you separate this from your consumerist side of things and let's treat this one as purely a library of information. We don't want hyperbole and all this thing that we have with the consumer side of things. I mean, that's a different realm again. We don't want to be a customer for information and library wealth. That should be free for all.
Yes,
the Greeks understood this.
Yes. Yeah. And I'm sure you've come across, I've followed various paths of thought through the internet and eventually come across academic places where they'll only let you have stuff for $30 and things like that.
Yeah, it's even some of these medical studies that are like my virology, but there's loads that they won't give me access to unless you pay a fee. You know, and they're supposed to be on public records.
Well, it costs money to access these things, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that's one of the things that is most difficult for people is that we think we know facts, but in fact, nearly everything we need to know is hidden until we look really closely.
Yeah, Matt, I think I've used the analogy. We've got 3% of world knowledge to deal with. The other 97% is hidden. So yeah. If any of us can make any sense out of this, we're all geniuses.
Yeah. At the same time, random information does pop up for specific individuals, doesn't it? I have a suspicion that we are getting to know what we need to know, no matter how much of it is hidden.
Yeah, I think there's enough of the iceberg on top to see what's underneath it.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Enough has been revealed for us to go, okay, we can work out maybe 50% of, we can use technology like you can, we can fill in the gaps and resequence that DNA code. We can make ourselves a mammoth too. You know, we can. I think that's where you're going with all this.
Yep.
I mean, that's an interesting one. Someone popped up before, a friend, you know, Nicholson 1968.
Yeah.
He was putting something up to do before about this 2045 and the human extension of life. I think it's HUMAI, human resurrected artificial intelligence. Now, what the hell has human resurrected artificial intelligence got to do with us getting anywhere near community spirit?
I'd say it's more or less completely the opposite.
exactly.
Because really, a community, when it is functioning well, and small bits of communities do, it's actually all the time kind of creating niches and feedback loops and satisfying that particular need and all the rest of it. But it's completely necessary that that the natural systems do that. As soon as we introduce technology, management chips, whatever it is, then it's a bit like interfering with the weather. You've made changes that mean that the original thing doesn't work properly.
The only thing that's ever meant to change your genome is nature, because it will either allow you to adapt and survive, or it won't. It won't give you any protective gene markers for the next one. Whatever it decides to, you know, strengthen the weak, doesn't it, usually? It generally empowers the larger group and abandons the weak, doesn't it, to give it its best chances of survival?
Yeah.
So if that's going to happen in the human race, then you don't want synthesized artificial variants when nature can do pretty much the same job, as long as you don't tinker.
Yeah, I wonder
if you've got protections, they might actually keep you alive a lot longer than the system will.
Yeah.
As brutal as she is.
Well, and I mean, another thing it seems to me that's important is that people start accumulating authority by demonstrated expertise. We seem to have a lot. I mean, basically, when I listen to the guys from the county council here, they seem to be saying, I'm sorry, I can't do my job. That's what they seem to be saying to me. And it's clear to me that we've got people with something a long way from expertise actually kind of governing the whole thing. And again, individual communities are going to find it, I suspect, a lot easier to deal if they actually work on expertise and make sure that the individual who's likely to do the job best is in the position to do the job whilst that's the case. Doesn't have to be the same person all the time, probably wouldn't be.
I wouldn't allow them to be an expert. I'm like, I don't recognise you as an expert. What's your official position?
You demonstrate.
You're an officer.
Yeah.
You're not an expert. I don't recognise you.
Yeah.
As simple as that. Ends that facade that you think I'm going to agree that you're an expert. No, I don't. I have no idea if you're an expert. I just know you have an office and a duty as an officer. So get on with it.
Whereas actually among men and women, what we tend to see happening is that the individual who is most suited to, I don't know, leading or whatever we want to call it, can get into that position, do the job for us until it's done. And then for the next job, there'll be somebody else who's got the experience. But expertise should be applied to people who've demonstrated that they can successfully do the job. And I don't see any of our current world management team demonstrating that they've got anything like that kind of skill. In fact, if violence is the last resort of the incompetent, then most of them are incompetent.
So are you actually challenging councils on anything in particular, or is that kind of private right now?
No, the reason why I've been doing what I've been doing for the last 4 years is we decided to challenge the council before we knew enough to do it properly.
Yeah.
And since then, I've not had a single brown envelope with a window in it from anybody. I just turned around and walked away. However, clearly, I'm going to be looking a lot more closely at the way education's going here, and that I will be dealing with people who are challenging authorities. Mm. And I've no doubt that I shall have to do it in the long run as well. But
it's funny, actually, because I've actually just triggered the tripwire, shall we say, with the council. If you know what I mean.
Yeah, I do.
Tripwire's just gone. And I'm going to have to obviously write a letter to the chief executive officer, but I've got something drafted. I mean, if you want to play a tune or two, I can give you an idea of what I'm writing to them, because I'm curious of this post office box they're using. The more I've looked into that, the more I'm really concerned that what they're doing is obviously fraud.
County council acting in obvious fraud. I think we'll play a couple of tunes and come back that, shall we? I know we're supposed to finish at 11 o'clock, but I know nobody else is on. If you're happy to chat, I am.
Well, they all wanted me to do a ninja, so I thought, well, we'll do two birds with one stone.
No, it's really great. It's really great to have you on to chat, Lee. Thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
I'll put on a couple of tunes and then we'll do an extra half hour or so, shall we?
Yeah, why not?
So how about Something Better Change by the Stranglers? Yeah. Back with you shortly, guys.
Dr. Rock's radio show. Every Thursday night at 9 on raconteursnews.com. We go to 11.
And that was Motorhead there, and On Your Feet or On Your Knees. So, on your feet or on your knees, Lee?
I'd rather sit.
Yeah.
Apparently that's good. Dangerous for you now as well, isn't it? Sitting down, it kills you, apparently.
Well, I must admit, I think for many years I've regarded chairs as a bit of a menace. I think we were designed to squat.
On a chibatsu box.
Yeah. So, I mean, what everything boils down to here is getting all of these various people who've suddenly discovered they've got an axe to grind to learn to help to grind each other's axes. And round here, nearly everybody who's doing anything is either working for the council or is funded at arm's length by entities that are in turn funded by the council, who tell us they've got no money. So it seems to me that actually talking about how to resist the council is a good way of spending, the last sort of 25 minutes or so. And how did you trip their wire? I know exactly what you mean. If something like, I know exactly what you mean. Somebody registered a complaint about a place we were staying in last year, and the Department of Environmental Health came, the Department of Health and Safety, the Dairy Inspectorate, Department of Public Protection, and this was from one anonymous complainant. So what did you do, Lee? What have you done to rile them, mate?
Well, I haven't given the extortion that they're demanding, it would appear.
You're refusing.
Demand something to be paid every April or so.
Yeah, I know the one, yeah.
That thing. Well, as if you do a bit of discovery on this kind of stuff, you realise that when you are in that position where they're demanding some kind of money or you're going to go to court, this summary judgment, again, is just acting on your person, which this fictional name they think all of these statutes apply to and that you represent. So what I thought, for me personally, the bigger problem is, do they even apply to you anyway? I mean, they're governed under the Municipal Corporations Act as trustees, for a start. Now, that's a corporation.
Yeah.
How do their corporate rules apply to me in my dwelling while I'm physically where I am? That's my question, because I didn't take any oaths for anything. I've never swore allegiance to anyone, and the only thing I believe are taxable are persons. So how does that apply to me again? Because I live and breathe and I can prove that I've got a heartbeat.
So what do you do to avoid the summary judgment?
Well, what I've decided to do is, obviously before it triggers the summary judgment itself, I thought I'd write just a quick private and confidential notice for discovery. So again, you can critique this if you want, because I don't know how you write to people. I've no idea the language you use or if it's correct or incorrect, because I think either way, it doesn't matter how we write to these people. We've got a corrupt coup d'etat of a government that's imitating a government. It's cloned a government, and we think it works for us, and it doesn't. So I don't think it really matters how we talk to it, because it's not really going to listen at the moment, unless we change the people who work in the office.
Yes.
The ones who enforce it and just follow. So what I thought we'd start with, just to start a quick sentence, we've got, 20 minutes or so. I begin with this. It is my belief that you, whoever the CEO is the man who has overall responsibility whilst you occupy the office of Chief Executive Officer for the Council. I expressly and exclusively entrust you to investigate. Now, I'm using the word investigate because they're going to send court proceedings and make their quasi-little court system work for them. You have to get them to investigate, otherwise they haven't really got anything from you to object about. It's just going to go as if. It'll just get treated as if no one's whinged about this.
Yeah, and you're right. You're going to write this letter rather than email it to them.
Well, it's handwritten, yeah.
Blue
ink, by my own hand. So I'm expressly entrusting these people because they're trustees. I'm using that word because I'm recognising them as a trustee. You're not anything else other than that. You're a trustee under the Municipal Corporation Act itself.
Doesn't that govern
what you do.
Doesn't that mean they hold liability for what they do?
Of course they do. They're bound by it because they agree to oaths and all this kind of stuff under that system. But how does it apply to you?
Mm.
It's their rules. It's their corporate membership rules. It's their decorum, their codes. So I'm going to carry on. I'm entrusting you to investigate this matter. Again, I'm trying to keep it neutral because I'll let them figure out what it's all about.
Yeah.
Reminding you to recall to mind, bringing it to the forefront of your mind, your thinking mind, because you're the I in this, aren't you? He's going to have to think about this one. The council codes of conduct, including the 7 principles, namely transparency, honesty, and integrity. So I'm anchoring in those 3 to them, as well as a trustee.
Yeah.
At all times, whilst acting as a public servant. So again, I'm enforcing the idea, you're a servant, you're a trustee. You're not just an officer under that rule system. You're also a trustee position.
Yeah.
It is also expected that you sign your responses and findings in wet ink signature and by your own hand and in your private capacity. Now, the reason they're asking private capacity is if we go to any kind of court system, he's the man that's making the claim as far as I'm concerned if he replies in a negative way.
Yeah.
He then assumes that he's the man that's making the claim now, because he believes the other guy, whoever that be.
Yeah.
So it will be a private matter, because you're going to sign this privately. Now, publicly, you probably can't, which is probably why yours went all silent.
Yeah.
Maybe this is, you've already done this. I'm just explaining to people, this is how I approach it. And I wouldn't say don't necessarily copy me, but this is how I write to people.
Yeah.
So by your hand. There appears to be a man, this is my claim, there appears to be a man who is making a claim I owe a debt. So please document and verify who is making the claim for the alleged debt. Second part, please document and verify that the man who is making the claim I owe a debt is not the same man who is operating the post office box from which said demands are emanating from. Right? Because I don't know who owns that post office box.
As far as
I'm concerned, it's not even coming from the council. It's coming from a privately operated box.
Exactly. I mean, that's, is that permitted? Is it?
I look into it. All I ever keep seeing related to it is criminal fraud. Right. Postmaster needs permission for you to find out who it is if you suspect fraud's being operated through it. And it's usually to do with businesses operating as a customer base. You know, like Britannia Music.
Yeah.
It's operating like that, privately. Now, I'm not sure whether the council can do that, so I'm asking them to investigate who's operating the box sending these demands, because I'm not sure it's coming from the right place, is it? So it's there for him to think about.
Yeah.
Third one, please document and verify with facts and evidence and witness it with first-hand knowledge that council codes and rules properly apply to me. Now, I'm saying properly, because if you look at the legal definition of proper, it's the truth. It's the real, not the imaginary.
Nice.
Didn't like, I have a proper child. You know, I'm a proper child of my father. I really am. So I want them to apply to me. You know, how do they properly apply to me, factually? The living, breathing man. You know, I'm a living, that's a fact. The council isn't. So if there's a man there breathing and living, and he's alive, then fine. Now, I would accept that, but if you're a corporation with no life, how can you even possibly make a claim against me? How did I foment a contract with you when you got no hands? Yeah? You see the logic in it?
I certainly can, yeah. And I think it's, you've clearly found information about the nature of these people's jobs and the nature of their office and
their role playing.
Yeah, and they're frequently playing outside their role, aren't they?
Yes, exactly.
More or less all the time. So this kind of thing we're talking about with reference to the regular payment that's expected every April would actually work for more or less any claim that's being made by these fictional authorities.
Yeah, Jimmy's just asking a question there. Yeah. Does Lee use a notary or a registered mail when sending letters? I send registered mail.
Yeah.
Just so I got a signature at the end of it. So I know something received it.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. And, do you use a carbon copy?
Sometimes I'll do it in triplicate. It depends what I feel like. Who else I'm going to send it to.
Yeah. Tony's put one in there as well. He's put please document and verify. Please is begging. Should you not require them to document and verify?
You can, but I don't mind being polite.
No.
I mean, it's my language. I understand please. I use it every day. Can I have that, please? I'm not begging for it. I don't beg my girlfriend for anything. Do you want a cup of tea? Yes, please.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's an innocent word to me. It's just everyone recognizing it generally as, you know, a request, don't they? Please, may I?
Yeah.
It's a little tip, a little elbow, you know, can I? No problem with it. No problem with it. Again, it lessens the idea that this is aggressive. I'm not being aggressive asking that. It's please.
Do you think it's necessary to go for the CEO, or do you think you can run this technique with people who are on advice lines and, you know, on the other side of a piece of glass trying themselves to process whatever it is you're in there trying not to process?
Well, I'm going to put two clauses in now which will explain exactly that. All right, so it says, furthermore, you shall not delegate this matter to a lesser officer. I expressly entrust you as the public servant and will only recognize you and responses from you concerning your investigation, and I will not recognize any other entity except you, and all others will be refused for cause and returned to sender, and I will expect you to respond from within your office.
Yeah.
not from your post office box or whoever you think. Because what they do is they pass the same response back down to the same guy who's making the demands, whoever this guy is, whoever. If it even exists, he sends it back to him. I'm going to assume it's a him because it's a male name.
Yeah.
Right. So I'm trusting him. I want his reply and only his reply. It's my request and I'm entrusting him. If he breaks that trust by passing it down, then he should really be removed because there's obviously a conflict of interest somewhere.
And he's not fulfilling his,
he's not fulfilling his duties under integrity, honesty and transparency.
Yeah.
So here's the final clause. Notice to you is also notice to the monitoring officer and the financial officer, as you may consult these officers during your investigation to discover the facts and the evidence I seek, which I've already laid out in the first three questions, right? That's the information I seek.
Yeah.
The reason why I've done that is because the monitoring officer is the one who sets up the court, the quasi-court system, when they all put on their roles, their new hats, and pretend they're in a court where they then judge you summarily based on the so-called law, which is just process under civil law.
Yeah. What did you call that officer?
He's the monitoring officer.
The monitoring officer. I've not heard of him.
Well, the chief executive officer has to consult him all the time in a permanent chain because he's the one that has to set up the court system, the clerks, all of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's all to do with money. So he also has to talk to the financial officer about this because it's accounting, right? They're the three top men. I go for the pyramid at the top and I involve all three. So there's none of this, well, I spoke to this just, we spoke to the man in general and he's an officer. He's entitled to do his duty. Well, I don't care. You're going to get, I want you to consult with all of them. All of you can't lie to me. Can you? Yeah. There's a little, there's a triangle of truth there that one of you's got the truth. You're telling me all three of you investigated this and not one of you could find that if I was. Just because I'm in a physical location, your codes apply to me.
Yeah.
So good luck. You know? So I've involved those three for that purpose expressly. Yeah, you can consult with people, but you're not passing it down and redelegating it, which I know you can under your own council codes. You can give someone else the authority to do your function, but I'm not allowing you to.
Mm.
So.
And what do you think, what do you expect back?
Well, I expect some kind of snotty letter and some kind of legal department to tell me something, but I'll still carry on. But what I've also included here is, I trust 28 days is more than enough time to gather the information I seek. This instrument was made in triplicate. If it be discovered that it was a genuine, honest mistake or is simply an erroneous claim, the transgression can be forgiven at a future time as a simple misunderstanding. So I've left them a complete door open on this one as well. If you've made a mistake, let it go.
Yes. Yes. And of course, I'm sorry. There's been an honest mistake. It's perfectly valid.
That's my letter. Very simple, very clear. No fancy language. No counterclaims that anything. I'm like, okay, prove all of this. You're making this claim and just let me know who's operating these boxes. You've got the right to tell me.
Yeah.
I don't really want to go to the postmaster and start investigating if it's a fraudulent box. That's going to look bad on you. I'd rather you tell me first who owns it.
It's going to be very interesting to see what comes out of that.
But it could be a bit later. I know this, it might be my, I had 7 days to reply and I think I've just gone over my 7th day, so it might just kick in automatically. But I've also asked them to put a stay on this. What did I do here? That's it, yeah. These are questions of fact, not questions of law. As a sign of good faith, I request that you place a stay on any further proceedings whilst this is investigated. So in other words, instead of you just going to summarily judge this and set off a fine system where you pass your debt and start taking an attachment of earnings off me, dipping me benefits, I'm basically trying to stop that by saying, at least put a stay on this before.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and that's your good faith. You're going to have to show me good faith that maybe there was a mistake, but at least stop it.
Yeah.
Don't let this automatically ride on and start incurring unnecessary charges, which have already been proven unlawful. That it doesn't even merit the charges. The charging it as a council, you know, to generate this nonsense. It's not worth the fines they escalated to.
No.
It's just ridiculous. So it has to be challenged just on that prima facie alone. There's no justification for it.
Yeah. Well, it'd be very, very interesting to see what comes back from that.
I'll let you know.
But basically, more or less, any demands that are being placed on anybody by a so-called council can be challenged in the same way, can't it?
I just don't think you need fancy language. I think as long as you understand that they have a language in set into their head, legally speaking, they've been trained to have certain legal trigger words. But we've also got our common vernacular, you know, street speech. Yeah. You've got to get them on both levels somehow with your language. Otherwise, they're going to read robot or they're not.
I sometimes think that what we need actually is some new words for some of the things, because it is our language that's tripping us up, really.
Jimmy's asked an interesting question. Lee, are you not making a mistake taking your private claim out here in the public as opposed to, like, wording or presenting it as if it were a fictional character and how we might respond? I don't think there's any mistake discussing anything, Jim, to be honest. Not sure about the second part. As opposed to, like, wording or presenting as if it were a fiction. I mean, let's face it, they're all fictions, aren't they? I mean, these officers are fictions. They're just there to play a role. A functionary, you know.
Yeah. And you're establishing that you're a man by writing with a pen.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm writing privately, but that's why I'm asking him to answer privately, because he should know. There's no, no knowledge of the law is no defense. Or yeah. Excuse of the law, ignorance of the law is no defense.
Yeah.
Well, that's entitled to every man. It doesn't just apply to just things called officers. You know, officers can't know that. Only men and women know the law, apparently, don't they?
That's it. None of this stuff.
How the hell can I read it if I'm a dead corpse and I don't exist?
Mm.
You know, it's either one or it isn't. It's either, you know, I struggle with this idea that I have to read the law with eyes. Yeah. I was born with them. Were you born with eyes? Yeah. Well, how was the council born with eyes to see any law it makes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes no logic. That's what I struggle with. It's not what I write or whether I do things publicly or privately. It's what am I dealing with? What's the reality here?
And the reality is that there is a man or a woman who is pressing the enter key or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're the ones who need to be held to account, and they really don't seem to like that.
And I know it's a tough for them because they're trained to do that function, but the system's bent towards us and they're actually taking part in the fraud. And I don't think they truly accept that they're doing that, because it's a job.
I don't think a lot of them know. I mean, the thing is, the whole thing boils down to, it always boils down to the money, you know, the farming, the education, the health service, all of it boils down to the fact that the money itself is a fraud. And if people don't realise that, and I don't think many people do, even in the council, they're actually operating at a much deeper level of dishonesty than even they suspect, those that know.
Yeah, I mean, if the government's here to help you, then people need to understand that they are the government. They help each other, don't they? How can you have a repressive government and say it's yours if you keep voting for it and it does exactly the opposite of what you're willing?
Yeah.
That makes no sense to me either.
Well, I think Simon Spaniard made good sense of that last week when he said that basically half of government's missing and it's the half that needs to be holding these men and women to account for what they're doing, and that's us.
Yeah, that was a cracking show, that, by the way, for you first. That was a blinder.
Simon's always good, and, you know, our man who was on the inside, on the outside, he's in a hit, and this is what we're talking about here, is basically what he was suggesting, is that this is exactly what we need to do. If government is going to work properly, it needs to be held accountable by those people for whom it is supposedly working.
Yeah, especially if you're... I mean, there's the other thing with the council. They're only a management system. They don't own the land. Now, it really depends whether the system regards you as land.
Uh-huh.
You know, maybe our perception of our understanding of land is a little bit different to theirs, because when you hear about people saying, oh, it's the laws of the land. Yeah. Land is property. So how does that apply to me? Yeah?
Yeah.
Common law of the land. That's feudal law. You don't want feudal law. That's going back to tyrants and kings. Why would you go under that?
You end up hanging from a rope.
Yeah. And dueling, you know, whatever it used to be called. That only got banned nearly 100 years ago. You know, shooting each other. So why would you claim that when you weren't alive? You were never a party to that mindset. Because I don't think you've still got a dark age mind, have you? Have you? You know, that's what I don't get. It's like, it's the law of the land. Yeah, but land isn't your word, it's theirs, and that means property to them. So it's law of the property, and if that's what you're applying yourself to, then you're their land. Isn't it?
Which is exactly how they treat us.
Exactly, yeah. Or that you're property, somehow.
And we're not. We're most definitely not.
No. But that's how they're viewing you in this legal system. You're their property, their land.
Yes.
Crazy. But, you know, but they've got none of their own. They just manage it.
Yep, with our consent, apparently. And that's what it boils down to. What we're talking about here is whether or not we consent to the treatment that's being doled out to us. Because even the politicians recognise that we're governed and policied by consent. Yeah. So for us, it's just a question of where, when and how are we consenting?
Exactly. And I think a lot of it comes down to the idea of you being a British citizen and all of these titles they bequeath upon you as you become eligible, legally speaking, on paper. They're the things you've got to refute. These fictions they've created for you. You're a British citizen. You're a Commonwealth national. I'm none of those things. I'm a man that lives and breathes.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Nothing else applies. And otherwise, I'm going to have to put a hat on and role play. Mm. And that's pretending.
That's another argument for why one's letters need to be simple, is because only the simple words are genuinely sound, aren't they? Because, yeah. You know, man and woman, that's cool, but almost everything else is a legislated word with legislated meanings.
We could all communicate, you know, under 300, 400 years ago. It's when the King's English came in and bastardized the English language, and you got these people who came over and separated themselves from the commoners by having so-called elocution lessons.
Mm.
So they already artificially divide the public by putting on this posh accent.
Yes. Yeah,
that's a fact too. So we spoke to each other until we started perceiving others being different, special.
Mm. A couple of things spring to mind there. I've been fascinated for a long time by, you know, pidgin English, like spoken in Jamaica.
Yeah, I love it.
Recently realised that by doing that, you actually get away from using all of the words that might actually land you with responsibilities and liabilities unintentionally.
Yeah, I used to speak quite a lot with people, you know, messaging and stuff with pidgin English. I found it really endearing.
Yeah.
You know, it made me smile thinking, oh, he nearly got the word right there. Or I was just missing a few words, but you could generally get the gist of what they were saying.
And another thing I've heard is that English obviously is apparently a very difficult language to learn, presumably because it's actually designed to deceive right from the word go. But yeah. Certain foreign nationals have developed ways of learning English which only use like 300 or 400 words. So you don't say... if you don't know the word for heifer, you can say daughter of a cow.
Yeah.
And once again, if we could, when dealing with officialdom, certainly, if we could kind of reduce our vocabulary along those sort of lines, I think our letters would be working really well.
Yeah, I'm all for resurrecting some of these old words, you know, like scuppernog.
What's a scuppernog, mate?
Scuppernog. It's the same as a, you know, scoundrel.
Right.
Incorrigible rogue.
Yeah.
Is another word I quite like. Just bringing off these old ancient words that I just think are just lost in vocabulary today. You know, when you throw out a strange word that no one's heard and you see the double blink. What did you just say? Yeah. I was incorrigible.
Yeah, me and Synchro have both been described that independently by several people, and we did eventually have to look up incorrigible, and it says beyond reform.
That's the word. So I'm good when I say Dave Scammeron's incorrigible.
Yes.
You know, it's correct. Yeah. But my girlfriend does the same. She'll go out, I'll say to her, go out to people and just use this random word that you got in your head that you want to get out and use it in a sentence. So she goes to work and says, oh, I'm a bit discombobulated.
Yeah.
And they go, well.
It used to be one of my favourite tricks, that was to read the page of a dictionary each day and use one or two of the words in it.
Yeah, that's crazy. Yeah,
well, there's got to be some question as to whether using more complex language is safe, but it's completely safe amongst all of us. I just wouldn't do it when dealing with legal fraternity necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a lover of words and meanings, but if I want to colour the language, I'll, you know, I'll use synonyms and, you know, like we always do, we use just different variants of meaning of the same word, but it's only if you want to, you know, just make it colourful, as I call it, rather than just saying the hat, you know, the hat, the hat, the hat.
Well, I mean, that's another thing, is that one of the, there are many, many ways of inducing people's slide responses by kind of approaching subjects from ways that they maybe don't expect. But I have found that certain strings of words work particularly well and will work with lots and lots of people. So the how we speak to each other is also crucial to the chances of getting the message across, because sometimes you need to get it across before that slide response occurs.
Well, it's the voice as well, isn't it? If you're going to be a hysterical maniac and keep dragging people and say, look at this guy, look at this guy, you're probably not going to change anyone's opinion.
No, correct.
But writing things down in a very passive way and just being assertive as best you can with some of these officers, yeah. At the end of the day, we all just want reasonable, you know, explanations of what you think you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, time to reflect, chaps. You know, we kind of get the gigs gone a bit too far, and you're just openly stealing it now, and you don't really hide it.
And really, this is at the root. If we're going to get the freedom to cooperate with each other and to do things the way we need to do them, it's my suspicion that to a certain extent we're all going to have to buy that space by challenging the people who are trying to take it off us.
Yeah, it's the arrogance of them that they think the law protects them. You know, it's, well, the law says.
Mm.
Well, no, it's a code. It's actually a piece of legislation. It's a written code. It's a bill. It's not a law.
Mm.
So again, it's just factual evidence, isn't it? Circular logic.
And in order for that to be true, they have to be adhering to their own terms and conditions of employment and memoranda and association and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So most of them, even if these rules do, you know, do protect them, they'll only protect them if they're behaving absolutely properly, which the majority of them don't appear to be. In fact, some of them don't seem to know how they're expected to behave.
No. Which I think is why we should really exercise what we used to do and why we all went to school, is put pen to paper and learn to write again, because we're getting too lazy with emails. I would say to everyone, don't get into legal matters with emails. It's just fatal. They'll just speed up the process and get you in such a word mess. But before you know it, you'll say the wrong thing, or they'll say, oh, we got proof of that.
Yeah.
Before you even know it, at least with letters, it slows it all down. You got time to think about what you write rather than just doing a messy, angry email that could put yourself in so much trouble.
Yeah. And, an email is a fundamentally different thing from a letter that's written by a flesh and blood breathing human being and delivered through the post.
Yeah, it's admissible as evidence, but, you know, I just wouldn't leave that option.
Do you think that these bulk centres that are mass processing parking fines and liability orders and stuff like that, do you think they've arisen as a result of the kind of the casual email communication as opposed to letters? Do you think they could have happened if we didn't have what we've got?
Yeah, it's a council abattoir.
Mm.
You just line up the cows and, you know, one by one they go in and just do them all in one batch. I mean, doesn't that tell you something's wrong already?
Why?
Especially how many people aren't contesting this?
Yeah. Why is it? Is it because the internet's public rather than private? What is the difference between your stamped letter and your email? Why is it so important to them?
Because it gives them timestamps. Mm. It gives them merit that you had intent to reply. It gives them subject matter jurisdiction because you're actually dealing with a fictional entity. How do you know it's real that you're replying to?
Mm.
It could be an autobot for all you know. I know the technology exists where I haven't got a clue who I'm speaking to online when I'm dealing with so-called emails. So I keep it in the real world.
And
someone's going to have to put hand to paper on this.
Well, the responses you get do look like they're generated by an autobot.
Yeah.
At least the first one. And will you, I mean, my guess is that the letter you'll get back will be probably largely evasive, and you might have to ask the questions you've asked again. Is that what your approach would be, to keep asking the questions until you get an answer?
Yeah. I just don't recognise them if they don't come from it. The first time I'd done it, it came from the chief executive, and she actually said, yes, I am answering from my office. And
right.
She called by what I asked her to call me, and that was, you know, Lee.
Mm.
She put it in quotations, which I wasn't happy about. So I wrote to her and said, don't put my name in quotations. What are you trying to do? Are you separating me from something else? Should I call you Penny in quotations like it's something different?
Mm.
She didn't like that either.
And did she sign in her own name?
Yeah, she did.
Very good. What happened with that one in the end?
She done what I expected her to do, and she delegated it down to a lower minion.
Mm-hmm.
And then I done the same thing. I asked her again, and before I know it, she'd resigned. She signed to last year's
Actually, it's amazing how often that happens, that people slide sideways.
Quarter of a million she walked away with. Quarter of a million she walked away from. As a council trustee, £250,000 she walked away. Not bad, eh?
Mm.
where that should have went. Yeah.
Often the way it goes, but then what you got to do is just take it to the next one, really, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I don't see it as a battle. I just see this as long as I can stop them doing what they think they can do and actually get them to talk to me, because there's no point ringing them up. You're going to get a robot. I've had too many phone calls from people on the internet to waste your time doing that. Put it on paper. That's all they're interested in. Paperwork.
Yeah.
And witnesses, you know.
Yeah. Do you think there's any purpose in writing the word complaint on the top of it?
Nope.
Nope.
Claim. They're making a claim for, you know, it's a debt. How are they making this claim for a debt? If you complain, just let me complain about Hitler. I don't like this regime. So if it's fascism, we took over you. This is it. Well, I don't like it. We'll complain.
Yeah.
Is that where you want to lie? I don't. I want to make sure that whoever's claiming this debt has got lawful grounds to do so. Because I'm not bound by Israel's, am I? I'm certainly not property.
No. And anybody making any claim can be treated the same way.
Well, you can't just rush it through like it's summarily judged, as if nothing's happened. It's like, oh, they haven't contested it. They're quite happy with that. Let's throw them for the mill. You know, next.
And it is the lack of contest that does that, isn't it? Because basically the system's after low-hanging fruit.
The perfect analogy, Monty Python done it. They've done it in a sketch when it's like, crucifixion. Yes, one cross. Good.
Yeah, first cross on the left. Move along. Yeah.
And if you... You know, if you look at it from this point of view, like what you've done and what I'm attempting to do, we are, what's her name when he comes up? He goes, crucifixion? Go, no, freedom.
Yeah.
Freedom. And he told me it was all good to go.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. You've got to be that guy.
Yeah.
Instead of going, one cross, crucifixion? Yeah. Keep to the left. You've got to be the other guy who says, oh no, freedom.
Yeah.
You have to be now. That's what they were kind of telling you.
Yeah.
Just speak your mind. It's like, you're wrong. No, I'm going that way.
Which it's true. That's really good, that, isn't it? Yeah.
It's a good analogy, isn't it? It's a good way of looking at it.
Jimmy's put in the chat, he's put, interestingly, I frequented certain IRC chat channel, and some of the bots fooled me into thinking I was chatting with a real man or woman. Really clever. Have you come across that?
Yeah. That's why I don't really do chat rooms anymore.
Wow.
I just don't do them.
God, yeah, indeed. Hadn't occurred to me. Hey, Jimmy, are you real, mate?
They have a certain syntax of language. They don't use many words.
Right.
You'll spot them a mile away. That's why they call them trolls and shills, but if you look at the way they write, there's a style there. They don't use very intelligible big words, which I don't. Like you and I, we use certain words that just roll off the back of the tongue. Chatbots can't do that. They can't improvise words. They can't improvise humour half the time. It's just violent aggression. Designed to flare you.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, as my natural inclination is not to engage with people who are in such a state, or bots for that matter. It's one of the things I find very difficult about chat boxes is that, I mean, we think people treat each other badly in the real world, but in the chat boxes, they just seem to be completely without any kind of responsibility for, you know, I mean, effectively, if you say stuff that upsets somebody, you are committing a tort, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I see it happening all over the place in these chat rooms. It's one of the reasons why I'm choosing to focus on community is because even in places where I wouldn't expect to see people fighting, I see them fighting, and I don't understand it.
I had my baptism of fire years ago. I was on MySpace before I ever went to Facebook, and I was on there for about 5 years, mainly doing geopolitical stuff between myself and the Americans. Warned them not to vote in Obama, but they did anyway. And I remember having this strange connection or love of a religious forum, you know, or biblical stuff. And I was there for 5 years, and I'm telling you what, you and I have been on chat rooms before, I'll leave it at that. And when people get a bit arsy, there's a few warnings. Go to a religious forum that I went to for 5 years, and you will not believe what you saw on that, or what was spoken about people. I mean, talk about vile. I mean, poisonous stuff. That was a baptism of fire. Just being involved in that alone and trying to learn some nuggets of how people think and how twisted they are was an absolute gem. I'm glad I did it.
Yeah.
Because it really spun my perspective of what people think of each other.
Yes, indeed. And how quickly they can become riled. And also how difficult it is dealing with just little black shapes on a white background instead of an actual voice.
Yeah. I felt like a sword that got tempered through the furnace, and I came out a little bit harder after spending time there. Yeah. Really, really got a better understanding of vileness in all of its forms.
I think the fundamental lesson I learned from that is that it's just not like that for me with the people that I meet. I don't see people who are actually meeting in meat space, actually treating each other like that.
No one seeks it that I know. And no one seeks that. They don't want confrontation and anger and vile words. They don't want that.
Well, the thing is, I think, you know, people realize that, well, I mean, I quite often ask them, you know, if there's been a bit of an explosion of tempers, you know, when they've calmed down, is if somebody approached you like that, would it work?
Mm.
You know, if somebody just came and started slagging you off and shouting at you and then running off and slamming the door, would it make you more likely or less likely to, you know, to go along with them? And of course, it doesn't, but for some reason, people don't seem to realize it.
Yeah, I think that's why I use this little thing where I'll just insert a random statement, you know, just a statement out my own mouth as if I'm saying it to myself and see if people pick up on it.
Yeah.
Gauge the water that way.
Mm.
Just, if they respond badly, then you say, I'll just chat to myself, you know.
Yeah.
Others will say, why'd you say that?
Well, it's my hope that I think, as I said at the beginning of the show, I think that we have some techniques for challenging authority, and I think that is one of the things we need to do if we're going to stand any chance of getting our community to back together again. And I think it's been a really useful chat, Lee. I do.
Well, all that leaves me to do is say thank you very much, Doc. It's always a pleasure joining you, and I hope you have many more.
Brilliant. Well,
I'm glad to have you over here, man. Good.
I'll do my best. I'm really happy over here. Enjoyed your show the other night as well. Like I say, you're one of my, apart from Private Eye, you're one of my main connections with the real world, if the Daily Mail can be called the real world.
It is a dubious source, but we try and make some light of it.
I think that if we're going to properly embody a solution, we need to be aware of the problem.
Absolutely. We've got to look under the carpet instead of just sweeping the dust under it. It's not going to go away. The lump's going to get bigger.
Yeah. Too true. Well, Tar, very much for joining me uniquely. It's been a real pleasure having you on. It's always great to chat with you.
Absolute pleasure, mate. Absolute pleasure.
And I'll spend these last 14 and a half minutes or whatever running up to midnight playing a few tunes, I think.
Good call.
Okay. So here's Heal the Last Stand and Smile, a really sweet lyric, I think, and one that we might all bear in mind. Thanks, Lee.
Cheers, man.
No Tax for War there from my friend Litmus over at projectfreeman.com. Writes a good lyrics. Stick your tax up your cracks, your government whores. Before that, Tracy Curtis and Don't Sit Silently Whilst Governments Take What Belongs to You off the Thoughts in the Dark album. Fairly sound piece of advice that, I think, as Lee was suggesting, the last thing we can afford to do is sit silently whilst all this happens. And before that, Heal the Last Stand and Smile. Easy as a smile, it is. So we've worked our way to the end of another show. Thanks very much to Andy and Jason and Paul for the show before this one. Big thanks to Lee for coming on and helping me out there. I really enjoyed our chat, mate. And thanks to everybody who's out there listening. It's a busy time of year. Little difficult to keep everything together, but we'll be back next week, hopefully with a guest. In the meantime, I'm going to play out with a couple of tunes. First one's by Slade. Slade made it onto all three shows on Raconteurs News so far. This one's called Find Yourself a Rainbow. I'd just like you to kick back, close your eyes, and imagine you're getting into Noddy's little mind here. I think it's a fantastic vision. And we'll play out with one of the Doctor's Doctor tunes. And we'll see you all next week. Thanks for being there, folks. And remember, the light at the end of the tunnel may be you, or the bloke that's standing next to you, or the old deer on the other side of the road. All worth considering. See you next week, people. Keep it real, eh? Or try to.